You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Monday, 15 April, U.S. retail sales due at 2:30 our time. We get a sense of how strong that economy really is. I'm Simon Brown, coming to you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Nick Kunzer from Sanlam Private Wealth. Gold rallied hard late into last week. And then, of course, we did see the escalation in the Middle East, but also worries about rate cuts. We'll talk around that. And banks. So banks the big winners if we don't see rate cuts. Alex Monk from Schroders, massive spend on the energy transition, $100 trillion between now and 2050 to be spent. And then Stojange Fleming, UK non-dom tax change means for South Africa and everybody else, but are there also other alternatives possibly in Europe? This show brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Major Ernie Els golfing deal for 10 billion rand. Zimbali Lakes development. KZN North Coast Estate will probably be of the last golf course residential develops to be constructed in South Africa, says the world former number one. Business day, Tiger shakes up offering for cash strapped to consumers. CEO says group is restructuring into a leaner and meaner machine. Morning markets, it's red. US saw the S&P down 1.5%, NASDAQ down 1.23%. Over in the east, all red. Sydney up 0.2%. Everything else red. Tokyo off 1%. Hong Kong down 0.8%, as is Tencent. Commodities, gold 2,374. Brent, 90.19. Platinum, 987. Palladium, 1,051. They're all down this Monday morning. Rand, 18.84. Bitcoin, 65,300. And top 40 opening call, about 260 points to the red. That's a little over 0.33% lower.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Nick Kunzer from Sanlam Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early morning. Gold forever in a day was a commodity which was of passing interest. Obviously, since the pandemic, it's really been doing well. You and I have chatted many times about not perma gold bulls, but at a time you want to own gold, and certainly this is the time. Last week was quite wild. New York futures price above 2,400. I mean, in part, I imagine it was the well-telegraphed Iranian attack on Israel, but also the U.S. inflation that I think spooked markets a bit.
Yeah, morning, Simon. Yeah, that's entirely right. You know, gold is one of those, it's one of those sort of asset classes, and certainly, you know, it sort of languishes for decades, does absolutely nothing. And then all of a sudden, when the world is, I guess, at some sort of major pivot point, as I think it is now, gold comes to the fore. And then, on top of that, you've got obviously inflation concerns. And then, you know, at some point, you know, the US debt is a problem. And I think, you know, the world is looking at this and going, you know, the U.S. debt and their deficit, you know, at some point it becomes quickly unsustainable and you want to hold hard assets like gold. So you could argue that gold's in a little bit of a sweet spot. But I must say, just to add to the listeners, Simon, that, you know, gold, you know, over decades, it doesn't outperform the market.
Yeah.
But it just has its moments. And I think right now it's in a really nice sweet spot for those gold bulls.
Yeah, I take your point to that. It has its moments, and this is definitely one of them. And particularly around the U.S. debt. And also, we came into this year expecting 6 rate cuts from the FOMC. Now we're down to 2. I was reading over the weekend some folks saying, well, unless it's June or July, it's not going to be September ahead of an election. We might only end up with 1.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous as far as I was concerned. You know, we had some market watchers talking about 7, rate cuts at the start of the year. And you sort of looked at the environment at the time, and it was like market was all-time high, and NVIDIA was going crazy. The U.S., jobless numbers are fantastic. You know, inflation was not really rampant. And you just thought, that just doesn't make any sense. But of course, you know, the Fed have also been their own worst enemy. You know, they were sort of, they had that pivot in December with Mr. Powell.
Yeah.
You know, no one was expecting big rate cuts, and he had the dot plot came out with 3. So, but I guess the market just ran a little bit ahead of itself. I don't hesitate, excuse me, to say there's probably a there's probably two or three rate cuts coming. Maybe June's a little bit early, but I take your point. You know, it's getting ever closer to November, and they're not going to do a rate cut, you know, close to that period anyway.
Does this then help the banks? Because part of the thing, the banks are the higher rank, the jaws effect, and that means they've probably got, well, much of this year with that high rate, and we can see more good earnings coming through, both locally perhaps and offshore.
Yeah, you know, I was looking at that sort of sector, because obviously the U.S. banking season kicked us off on Friday, and J.P. Morgan took a big knock. It was the biggest drop in sort of 4 years. And you know, the one side you do, as you said, that net interest income actually was a little bit disappointing. You wonder how much is already in the price. And then I guess on the one side you've got this the benefits of the higher interest rates, but also you've got to watch out for those impairments. You've got to watch out for those delinquencies and credit cards. And they're starting to creep up a little bit. And I think that's concerning the market a little bit. And then closer to home, I think our banks personally are a little bit undervalued, quite frankly. I mean, Standard Bank's languishing near low of the year. I think it's unfair. I think these banks are so cheap. And regardless of the slowing SA economy, they're getting more of the earnings offshore, certainly outside of South Africa. So I'd hesitate to say these banks are a little bit undervalued from a South African point of view anyway.
Yeah, I take your point in that. Yeah, I mean, it's some consumer pressure, but certainly that jaws is still there. We'll leave it there. Nkunza Sanlam, Private Wealth, always appreciate the early morning insights.
Your money knows that reaching new heights means turbulence. When you invest in StanLib's Global Multi-Strategy Diversified Growth Fund, your money can withstand the unpredictable ups and downs caused by day-to-day market fluctuations. Because our partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management gives you access to a broad range of global strategies. Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Alex Monk, a global renewables analyst at Schroders. Alex, appreciate the time today. In terms of looking at the decades ahead, new energy infrastructure rollout, of course, this is everything from power generation, transmission and storage. Have we got a sense of what sort of dollar amount in terms of spend we would expect over the next couple of decades?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I mean, essentially, when you look at the requirements of our energy system over the next 30 years, which include both increasing energy demand as populations grow, we use more AI and data, but also as we think about decarbonizing and making that energy system more sustainable, we estimate around $100 trillion Wow. of new incremental investment spend needs to be made over that 30-year period. Now, maybe that spend doesn't all get reached if we don't sort of Sure. fully meet our sort of net zero goals. But even if you only get halfway there, that's still an awful lot of capital that needs to be deployed, and obviously is going to create lots of opportunities for those companies deploying it.
That is an absolutely huge number. And you made a point there. I mean, we talk a lot around the transition to renewable and the switch off coal, but actually a lot of this is around demand and around the fact that we have perhaps neglected our energy infrastructure over the last few decades. It's Sam Altman from OpenAI. He keeps on saying his challenge is not getting hold of NVIDIA chips. His challenge in the future is going to be power.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we think about how our energy system changes over the next 30 years, it is useful to break it down into those two chunks and say what actual overall energy demand and our energy mix looks like, you know, significantly increasing because of population growth, because of data, you know, your exact points on AI, that's potentially, you know, incremental electricity demand, sort of 2-3% on top of the existing base. It's growing, you know, comfortably double digits. And we're obviously seeing huge amounts of investment being spent there. And what that will do is create tightness in energy markets. And we will need to find a way to solve for that energy demand, whether it be through existing forms of energy generation or increasingly sustainable energy generation too, particularly when you think about the fact that lots of these hyperscalers that are building data centers to power AI models do have very ambitious sustainability goals as well.
You know, the focus when we talk around energy these days is pretty much on renewable. Is coal completely out of the picture, or is there still coal being developed and proposed in the decades ahead?
Yeah, so I think we've certainly seen a growing focus on energy security, particularly over the last couple of years, given the sort of tightness in energy markets that we've seen. And for many parts of the world, you know, energy security is going to be partly reliant on increasing, you know, coal usage. Now, I suspect what we will see is that coal usage will need to be partnered with carbon capture. ultimately as sort of regulatory environments change and our overall carbon footprint and carbon ambitions evolve. So I think we will see that. But I also think what's important is when you think about incrementally developing and spending on capital as quickly as possible, bring new energy to the grid, renewables is often the better choice than existing coal power as it is.
Yeah.
It's often cheaper. It's often much quicker to deploy. It's often much more flexible in terms of deployment. It can give individuals and regions autonomy because they're not relying on big centralized power stations that often have, you know, blackouts if there are shortages. So actually, while we do think coal will still be relevant, because again, for certain regions, we understand that that's obviously a big part of the mix, lots of renewable technologies and other technologies that are slightly cleaner in some ways actually make more economic sense now, as well as being, you know, better for the planet as well.
And from an investment perspective, I mean, a lot of times when myself, the media start talking around something, there's a sense of, well, it's too late. But we're talking, you know, 100 trillion, giant number. We're talking decades. This is a investment thesis that's going to run for a very long time. And it's going to be lumpy and have some ups and downs. But we can be talking about this in 5 years and 10 years and frankly, probably still 20.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point when we think about these long-term structural shifts that happen in our society. And you see this whenever you go back in history as well, whether it's the growth of sort of automobiles and oil in the early 1900s or the growth of technology in sort of the 2000 period, we always have these bumps along the road. And that's because the adoption of all these technologies is driven by both structural forces, but also cyclical forces as well that can sometimes cause an acceleration and sometimes cause a bit of a pullback. But, you know, stepping back to kind of the point you made at the beginning, the fundamental question we need to be asking here is energy demand increasing? And the answer to that is clearly yes, for a variety of factors. And therefore, we are going to need to be spending more. And then we also know that incrementally, a lot of that spend is going to be tilted towards more sustainable forms of energy, because we do need to address our carbon and climate change goals as well. And therefore, you know, even though we're going to have periods where we see maybe a little bit of a slowing down of new spending because of higher cost of capital or whatever it may be, you know, ultimately the long-term direction of travel over the next 20, 30, 40 years is still really, really strong, given the investment that needs to go in. And that's going to create lots of earnings opportunities for companies.
And is it, and focusing on the renewable space, and when we think renewable, we think wind, we think solar, and fair enough. Are there other technologies out there who, in the level of demand, are going to rise up? I'm thinking hydrogen, potentially also hydrogen as a storage source.
Yeah, so I certainly think when you break down again what our future energy mix looks like, we can electrify lots of things. But one of the things that electricity isn't fantastic at is creating lots of very energy dense heat. And so we will need, you know, forms of clean fuels in our future, A, as a means of powering industry which you can't electrify. Think about sort of, you know, steel production and heavy industry in that respect, or sustainable aviation, sustainable shipping, but also potentially as a form of storage too. So we do see hydrogen as an interesting market. We also see sort of e-fuels, the sort of hydrogen-derived fuels, whether that be e-ammonia or e-methanol, as being a really interesting part of the mix. Lots of sustainable aviation fuel is going down that route. But this is also a market that's still very, very young. And so again, coming back to your point around sort of bumps along the road, we are going to see bumps and troughs, and, you know, this won't be a straight line, but ultimately going forward, you know, that e-fuel mix is going to need to be there in our energy mix alongside fossil fuels with carbon capture and things like that. And again, that's going to create this overall blend of what our energy mix looks like in the future.
Yeah. And in essence, we live in a fascinating time. You referred to the early 1900s, and we're kind of there again, and we're living in the middle of it. We'll leave it there. It's Alex Monk, Global Renewables Analyst at Schroders. Appreciate the time.
Now that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. I mean, $100 trillion over the next couple of decades. Is this theme part of your portfolio? Are you digging around ways to potentially invest into it? Certainly, we'll be talking a bunch more around this on the show. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter.
There's no postponing the inevitable. Your money knew this day would come. And you know what? It can hardly wait to start giving some back to you. When you invest in STANLIB's fixed income funds, you can retire earning a regular income off your investments. Invest for more certainty at stanlib.com/more. STANLIB is an authorized financial services provider and a registered manager.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Lupa Tlhabi. He's director at Stonehage Fleming in the Legal Tax and Advisory Division. Rupert, appreciate the early morning. UK budget this year, a fair bit of surprise there in terms of changes to the non-dom tax regime. First question, what is non-dom? Is this just folks who are sort of moving to the UK, or perhaps even citizens but don't necessarily live in the UK?
Good morning, Simon. Yes, so non-doms are essentially people who don't have their origins in the UK, mm-hmm. but who have come to the UK, so they're a resident in the UK, and haven't yet made their permanent home here. So they are resident in the UK, they've come here for a defined purpose, perhaps a short-term employment contract, education for their children, etc. But if they can demonstrate that they're not in the UK permanently, so there's an event or a time at which they're going to leave, they can claim that they are UK residents but not domiciled here.
Gotcha. And that then has fairly significant advantages in terms of income and capital gains tax, in that they previously, for 15 years, they weren't being charged on it. Now that's been cut. The proposal is to cut that to 4 years.
Yes, exactly. So until the recent announcement, people who are UK resident and non-dom have been taxed on their UK income and their UK capital gains, but not their foreign income and foreign gains unless they bring them to the UK. There's been the additional benefit as if these people establish offshore trusts, so not mm-hmm. UK trusts, the income and gains arising in those trusts have not been treated as theirs. So that provides an additional attractive proposition for them. And recently, the Conservative Party have announced that this long-standing regime will be done away with and will be replaced with a much shorter regime based around residence rather than domicile. And that regime will last for only 4 years.
And if I was there already, and let's say I'm 3 years into my 15 years, do I then get moved into this new regime, or would I be grandfathered in and sort of kept on the 15-year regime?
No. So, Simon, you've then been in quite an unfortunate situation, having been here for 3 years. The new rules are due to take effect from 6th April 2025, mm-hmm. from the start of the new tax year. So then you'd be moving, either you've just missed the regime or you'd be moving into the last year of the regime, so you'd be able to take advantage of the new regime for 1 year, but that's it. But you certainly wouldn't have your existing structures or your existing tax position grandfathered. So yes, that would be something that would come to an end for you. And for those who've been here for longer than 4 years, really the door's slamming shut for them on the 6th of April in respect to their personal taxation, yep. but also structures which they've established. Those will no longer provide the benefit that they have done.
It's April next year. There's going to be an election in the UK between now and then. If the Conservatives are voted out and Labour comes in, it sounds like something that Labour might still want to keep anyway. So maybe the election isn't going to be such a game changer here. Or is there a chance Labour might revisit?
No, very much not the case, in the sense that this has been the policy of the Labour Party for some time to abolish the non-dom regime. And actually only last week, Rachel Reeves has announced that actually Labour Party are likely to go further. So with regard to the changes, the personal tax changes, they would be broadly the same. But some of the additional reliefs that the Conservative Party were proposing for a short period to ease the change, the Labour Party have said that they'll actually do away with. So, no good news on that front, I'm afraid.
But then, I was reading the FT Weekender over the weekend, and they were talking other countries are looking to pick up the slack. It's not the UK in particular. I mean, you mentioned education. You know, there might be a university that you particularly want your kid at. But countries in Europe, for example, Italy, are suddenly becoming perhaps more attractive if this law does go into effect.
Yeah, there are many jurisdictions internationally and in Europe who provide mm-hmm. preferential tax regimes. And to some extent, the UK has had an advantage over those countries because of the length of time that they've been allowed to come to the UK and have a preferential tax regime, but also the fact that the UK remittance basis regime, the non-dom regime, has been around for such a long time and it's regarded as being very stable. But if you are looking at elsewhere, people are certainly looking at Italy and also Greece as mm-hmm. As countries. And perhaps even other countries which provide, such as Spain and France, that offer sort of similar regimes, and actually some of them more attractive because they're longer than the four-year period. And of course, there's always places like Monaco and the Channel Islands, which can offer very low taxes, if any at all.
Got your point. So we're going to see some shifts. I think that's the key point. The UK deal has been there, it feels like, forever and a day, and then suddenly it literally gets yanked out of the way. We'll leave it there. Rupert Tlhabi, he's director, Stonehage Fleming, in the Legal Tax Advisory Division. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. I was chatting around Ellie's on Friday. A boom stock listed at a rand went to 10 rand and, well, now is in liquidation and, well, sellers at 1 cent. We asked if you ever held it. Two-thirds of you said you managed to avoid it. The rest of you, a bunch of you held it, but most of you losing money. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app at 6:30 a.m. Podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nubuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us an excellent rating in your podcatcher of choice, and we'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.